You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hello and welcome back to the podcast. As always, up to speed with Formula One. It's Monday night. You're tuning in to listen or watch to Mr. Mark Daly and Mr. Mark Hamilton. Welcome to one and all. Good morning, good evening, good afternoon, wherever you may be. It's Monday, no race this week, so this is a little bit more casual than usual. Not that we really have a super formal structure this show, but it's always just kind of a little bit fun to sort of kick back a little bit, talk about some of the news that we can be a little bit choosier about, to read tweets, read emails, and basically go off on more of a tangent than we usually do. But how's it going, sir? You look very fresh for a Monday. I'm completely bagged tonight. I must admit.
Yeah, I feel great. For those of you that don't know, well, you all know because we talk about this all the time. And by the way, I get feedback all the time about stop making your show so regional. It's this concept in podcasting where you don't want to be too regional because you're going to alienate so many of your listeners. But we're in the Pacific Northwest, we're in Vancouver. So whereas in, I think, a lot of North America, people go off to their cabins, they go into the mountains. We go into the mountains, but for a lot of us, we go out to the Gulf Islands. You take a ferry ride, there's cabins, resorts, relaxation. So I'm on one of the Gulf Islands. That's not even a Gulf Island, one of the major islands. My parents live here. We came for 4 or 5 days. My son loves it. The weather's beautiful. It's scorching hot. And as it turns out, just as we head back, you're going to be packing up the family and coming over here yourself.
Yeah, we'll be literally crisscrossing as we come across for the long weekend and stuff. So that's going to be pretty cool. But yeah, what's going to happen with the goats and the chickens and the ducks and everything that are usually like overrunning your yard and your property anyways? You know, I've seen a lot of things going on just, you know, a couple of streets over from my house. So I'm just sort of playing it that better that I probably don't know what's happening.
Yeah, I think we should probably keep it that way. And for anyone that's curious, if you're like me and you're quick to jump on Google to get a sense of what we're talking about, I'm currently on Vancouver Island, population, to be honest, almost 1 million. So it's not like it's a spryly populated place, and you'll be coming over in a couple of days. But I do want to say, you talk about the fact that we don't have a lot of structure on this show. Typically, the one thing that we do coordinate in advance is who's going to do the introduction. And last time, we couldn't even get that right. So we got slandered in the DMs last week about the fact that we couldn't even get that right.
That was awesome.
I apologize. And we did very clearly talk about who was going to intro the show. And before we get into some really interesting stories this week, I wanted to share one other comment too. One of our great listeners in Orlando in Florida, Andre, sent me a DM a couple of days ago. And it was a message from the Haas Formula One team. They had posted this, and I'm going to read it because it's just absurd. And it just shows how detached their social media team is from reality. But they posted this: soon we'll be filming a Q&A with Nikita Mazepin. We need your questions, though. Type them below. And then there's a smiling photo of Nikita Mazepin. So like total charm offensive. If you want to give away an hour of your life and chuckle unrelentingly, go to this thread and read the comments because it's hilarious. I can't believe the Haas social media team thought it was a good idea to post that. So if you got an hour to burn and you want to chuckle a little bit, I'd say go find that. We did respond, and our question was a little bit more sincere, and we got a lot of kudos and a lot of love for that. But yeah, I check it out. It's just a little bit crazy that their social media manager thought it was okay to post that.
You know, it's funny because what's that age old saying, never read the comments. I'm feeling that this is maybe the exception to that rule, because it sounds like there might be some interesting and humorous things too.
Don't read the comments to something you've posted, yeah, but true. You're welcome to read the comments if somebody else has posted.
Fair enough. Yeah. All right. Well, before we, like I said, we're going to cover some of the more, I guess, cherry picked news items for tonight, and also do some tweets and emails a little bit later on. But I thought this was cool. You sent me this one earlier today, but apparently Barcelona and Bahrain are both going to host, excuse me, tripping over my words here, we haven't even started. They're both set to host 2022 F1 preseason testing, which I think is pretty cool.
Yeah, I'm super excited about this. And I think it's important for a couple of reasons. One, I think the teams and the drivers were obviously unhappy with 3 days of winter testing this past winter. Typically, and you and I talked about this, in the past, you would have winter testing, you'd have in-season testing, you'd have a testing immediately after the season concluded. Winter testing could be 2 weeks of 4 days of testing in each week, and it's been parsed down. And this past winter, partly due to the cost cap, partly due to the new Concorde agreement, partly due to the fact that the reality of the financials just didn't mean it was necessarily feasible for the teams. They only did 3 days of winter testing. And this was particularly hard on the teams that brought a lot of upgrades. And this was also particularly hard on the teams that had new drivers who needed to get acquainted with the cars that they were driving for the season. So the good news is it looks like, and we don't necessarily know the specifics around how many days they're going to be in each location, but it looks like they're going to set up camp in Barcelona for a couple of days. And then 2 weeks later, they're going to transport the entire organization down to Bahrain to conclude winter testing. So it's good because, and this will probably be one of the most exciting winter testing sessions we've ever seen, because Barcelona is going to be the first opportunity that we're going to get to see the 2022 car. So obviously we're going to have some unveilings in January, February, and possibly a little bit of March, but principally, this will be our first opportunity to see something that's going to resemble the cars that line up on the grid at the beginning of the season, which probably won't be Australia, but we'll get to that in a couple of minutes. But yeah, super, super excited to see this. And I'm glad that they've split it. It gives the teams the opportunity to shake down the 2022 cars, go back to the factories, make some last minute revisions, and then roll into Bahrain for some more intensive testing.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. So it looks like the way that they're planning it right now, looks like the first test in Barcelona is going to go around the week of the 23rd. And then there's going to be a 2 week break.
That's February
of 22. That's correct.
Right.
And then they'll have a 2 week break, and then they'll head off to Bahrain for the second test, which is going to start about the 10th of March. Then they're going to stay there because it sounds like they're going to have a doubleheader in the Middle East with Bahrain opening the opening Grand Prix, and then Saudi Arabia getting the second race of the year. I think they're planning it the week afterwards. So it sounds like right. We're going to get a pretty hefty dose of Saudi Arabia in, you know, fairly condensed in over like the end part of this year. It's going to be coming online, obviously, and then early next season. So I guess this schedule is going to kind of evolve over time. But yeah, I think this is a great idea. They certainly need the extra time with the new cars and everything like that. And I completely understand why they've tried to limit the testing, because I mean, back in the day, it was pretty ridiculous. It's just like they were almost using excuses to get into the car and drive around and put a couple hundred miles on the car. And it was just, it was almost excessive. Well, it was excessive. So, but still, I mean, the way that it is now, what we saw last year, it was just, and we're seeing now that some of the teams that struggled in preseason testing and didn't get the miles in the car, I mean, they have took them a long time to find their feet.
Something that I've become really excited about over the course of the last couple of years is potentially one day going to winter testing in either Barcelona or Bahrain. From what I've understood, and obviously I've never been, is it's kind of like a glorified free practice session, except that you have much closer track access than you typically would during an actual Grand Prix. One, it's super cheap. You can buy a pass that'll get you into the track all 3 days. You can walk around. You have access to all the grandstands. It's something that's actually pretty exciting to me now, and not just because I'm a gigantic Formula One nerd. But the other thing that I was reading today is after they'd made this announcement, there was a run on the hotels in Barcelona from fans that are actually hoping to attend. So it sounds like Formula One's actually expecting unprecedented demand from fans that want to attend the Barcelona session. So
that's cool.
As the tickets become available and the dates seem to be solidified, people are buying up blocks of hotel rooms. And I would expect that we'll see a crowd in Barcelona for this winter testing, unlike anything we've seen before. And I think partly it's because the sport just seems to have so much momentum right now. Spain is an accessible place for North Americans and American fans who might want to travel and check out a little bit of Formula One and do a little bit of touristy stuff at the same time. But also, it's just cheap. Getting into winter testing historically has been really cheap. It's really accessible. And of course, with the 2022 cars being unveiled, it's the opportunity to see them up close and personal in the flesh. I think it's pretty cool. And honestly, I would love to do a winter testing, but in this case, it totally makes sense, which is you're going to go to Barcelona. You get to experience that track. It's usually a little bit cooler, which I think is good for the teams to understand how the suspension and the tire setups work in a cooler temperature. And then you go to Bahrain and you get to experience an entirely different type of climate.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, I know I've plugged it many times, but Barcelona is a great place to go and watch, and it's a great place to go and visit as well. So certainly that should be on everybody's list. But moving back to Saudi Arabia, Mark. So the race promoter, Prince Khalid bin Sultan Al Faisal, says that their preference is to be near the front end of the calendar. And so they've just started releasing the tickets for public to buy up for this year's race. And he had to say, quote, "For us as a promoter, we prefer not to be the one of the last races. Teams can do really well in the first races, and then other races have become not so interesting as a promoter. We wanted to have a race in the beginning of the season, but in time we had to do work for the track and prepare the track. And we couldn't have a race in 2021 at the beginning of the year. Our decision was to have a race at the end of 2021 or wait to have an early race in early in 2022. Our decision was that we wanted to race in 2021. So now we are discussing with Formula One about what is best for us to have our race in 2022, and hopefully we can get to an agreement," end quote. So that is actually kind of interesting because, I mean, traditionally, the opening race of the year for many, 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 many years has been in Australia. And obviously that's changed over the last year or so, what with the pandemic and everything that's going on there. And then it was going to be moved into November of this year, but due to the, you know, the struggling vaccine rollout in Australia and a spike in COVID cases has unfortunately led to that to be canceled. But they didn't really seem to, they actually seemed to embrace the fact that they could move the Grand Prix to a later point in the season. And by them, I mean Australia, whereas the promoter for the new Saudi Grand Prix seems to be quite counter to that position. I found it quite an interesting contrast in opinions, let's put it that way.
I think what's becoming quite clear, and we're probably not going to see a copy of the draft calendar for 2022 for probably another month or two.
Yeah.
Do we see it in the summer break or shortly after the summer break? But I think what's becoming obvious is Australia is probably not going to open 2022, and I don't think it's necessarily by their choice. I just think Formula One's going to play it safe. I think the race organizers in Australia want to play it safe. I know that 6 months seems like an eternity, but I think they probably want to make sure that they play it safe and back it off to the back half of the calendar. But I think you're right. The beginning of the calendar is typically an attractive place to be, and I totally get it in terms of the Saudi position on this one, which is ideally you don't want to be in the back portion of the calendar, because what we've seen since 2014 is that if you're one of the last two or three races on the calendar, the race is meaningless because the championship's already been decided. Mm-hmm. Now, in this case, it's a little bit unique because Saudi, the Jeddah race, which would be the debut for Formula One in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, it was never intended to be on the calendar for 2021. In fact, the race organizers are working overtime to get the track ready in Jeddah. It's a street track. The layout's similar to Baku, although I think it's going to drive quite differently. But they're working overtime to bring this track to life. And it really just came down to the fact that Chase Carey and Liberty went to the Saudi group and basically said, look, we've got some unpredictability in the 2021 calendar. We need to get you on the calendar or get you in a position that you could host mm-hmm. a race, because we don't know necessarily what's going to happen with some of these other traditional tracks. And ultimately, I think the Saudi group was like, sure, we can certainly make that happen. But by design, Saudi was always designed to be linked up with Bahrain at the beginning of the season. And I think what we're probably going to see next year is we'll go to winter testing in Bahrain. We'll see the opening race of the season in Bahrain, and then we'll kind of back that up with a race in Jeddah about a week later. The other interesting thing too is, as much as Jeddah is going to be interesting for obviously a lot of political reasons, which we can talk about in the Spaces chat this week, because there's a lot of people asking questions. But I think what's going to be interesting about it is we're only going to be in Jeddah for a couple of years. The entire design on the Saudi Grand Prix, Saudi's presence in Formula One, is that Alex Wurz's track design team is developing and constructing a dedicated circuit in Qiddiya, which is kind of a resort element or resort area outside of the capital of Riyadh. So we're going to be in Jeddah, which is on the eastern coast of Saudi on the water, for two or three seasons. And then we're going to move inland to Riyadh. So there'll be a dedicated circuit in Qiddiya. So regardless of whether people love Jeddah or they don't love Jeddah, it's ultimately just an interim track, because ultimately we'll move to a dedicated track in Qiddiya. Now, there's also been conversations about the fact that, hey, if Jeddah does play really well and it does draw a lot of people, they could ultimately alternate between Qiddiya and Jeddah as well. So some interesting dynamics up there. And I think one of the reasons Jeddah is so important for Saudi, for the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, is Jeddah is being positioned as very much the Dubai of Saudi Arabia, in the sense that it's much more progressive. It's much more moderate. They're designing it as a resort city to draw in people from the region, from Western Europe, from Asia, from North America. And this is really designed to help bring eyeballs to that area of the country and help people understand that, hey, this is potentially somewhere you might want to come and visit. And again, we can talk about that during the Spaces chat, but definitely some interesting things there. And obviously, we've talked about this so much. It was always a no-brainer that there would be a race in this country, because I think as soon as Formula One, Liberty, Chase Carey inked that deal with Saudi Aramco, which is the national oil producer in that country, they would never do that unless they intended to host a race. And clearly that's what's going to happen. And we're going to see a race this season. And I think to your point, we'll probably see them probably second up on the calendar in 2022.
You know, it's very interesting. And just kind of bringing it back to Bahrain again, I mean, what a great job that they've done to really be one of those foundational, what do you want to call it, facilities, tracks over the past 18 months or so. I mean, they've really stepped up to host Formula One and been very flexible and really done a lot to accommodate them. So pretty cool. I think it's a deserving honor, if you want to call it that, to get the opening race of the year. I mean, just logistically, it also makes sense. And I think it's kind of cool. So anyways, Mark, let's take a really quick break here. When we come back, we're going to talk about Charles Leclerc. He's weighed in on what he thinks perhaps they should do with the sprint qualifying that we saw last weekend in Silverstone for the very first time. So we'll talk about that in a moment. So don't go away. We'll be right back after this short message from our sponsors. Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time, or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
All right. Well, welcome back to the show, everybody. It is Monday, July 26th. And just like that, in the blink of an eye, the summer's almost half over. It's just a little bit crazy. And just to remember, only one more month. And then you know what they say, no white pants after Labor Day. Don't ask me why I know that, but enjoy it while you can, my friends, because...
Have you ever worn white pants?
Hell no.
I've never even owned white pants.
No, yeah. Me neither, but...
Wait, is it white pants or just white in general?
I don't know, actually. But anyways,
yeah, I don't know. Now that I talk about it,
so this is another one I thought was kind of interesting. The headline I thought was a little bit, I wouldn't say misleading, but anyways, it says, don't use sprint qualifying to decide starting grid for Grand Prix. So I read into that a little bit that maybe Charles is being a little bit pouty. He's being a little bit unhappy about it, but it's quite contrary to that. Anyways, Charles had to say the following about the sprint qualifying, which debuted last weekend at the British Grand Prix at Silverstone. And Mr. Claire had to say, quote, I really enjoyed it. The Friday is normally so boring, honestly, in the car. I just want to be, I want the Friday to be done. Now, finally, we have a Friday where FP1 straight away, we need to be on it. We have qualifying straight after, which I enjoyed a lot more. Then sprint qualifying, that makes it exciting. And Sunday, a great race. If I give my personal opinion, I think maybe the qualifying should be the start of the race. The format needs to be maybe a little bit modified, but overall, I think it is definitely a gain, in my opinion. Maybe the Saturday do a race, but keep the starting grid from the qualifying, end quote. So, Yeah, interesting. I've kind of thrown my mind around this a couple of different ways. I guess everybody kind of has their own take on it. But what did you make of Charles's comments?
It's funny because it's something that I've spent so much time pondering myself. And I think people generally know how I feel. Mm. I had a lot of fun at Silverstone. I thought it was worth experimenting with. And I don't think that the race weekend format that was introduced at Silverstone necessarily compromised the integrity of the Grand Prix. Because I think for a lot of traditional fans, they're open to the idea of experimenting with free practice and qualifying and maybe even this concept of sprint qualifying. But I think the Grand Prix weekend or the Grand Prix event on the Sunday is sacred. That no matter what you do Thursday, Friday, Saturday, you can't take away from that in a meaningful mm-hmm. way. That said, as much as I enjoyed the weekend, I'm not completely convinced that it's perfect, and I would be open to continuing to experiment. And one of the things that kind of struck me earlier today, and I was going to message you right away, and like, I've got it, is a concept of Indy, which is, yeah, exactly, which is, look, if we're already going to do a qualifying session on Friday, which is fantastic. We'll do a practice session on Friday morning. We'll jump into qualifying. That's a good practice session because a lot of people will be at the track just because they're there for qualifying already. If we're already going to go through the lengths, and I know people are going to start firing slander at me on Instagram right now, and I can feel people getting their Twitter fingers ready. If we're already going through the procession of doing sprint qualifying on Saturday, why don't we at least have a conversation about doing a doubleheader weekend? And I know this is sacrilegious and I'm kind of getting off topic here, but it's something that happens in other championships. We've seen it in Formula E. We see it in the lower formulas. We see it in Indy. But if you're already going through the trouble of doing a sprint qualifying session and all the headaches that could potentially come with that and the debate about the meaningfulness and whether it should set the grid for Saturday, what if you just had two races in a single weekend and those are your majors that at a couple of events every single year, you have two full-pointed championship Grand Prix. So just an idea, and I know people are going to slander me like crazy because that flies in the face of protecting the integrity of the Sunday Grand Prix. But the more I thought about it, like if we're already putting in 100 kilometers for sprint qualifying, why not amp that up to a race? Maybe it takes a lot out of the drivers, the teams, maybe a car gets damaged, you can't get on the grid for Sunday. I don't know, but doesn't that risk already exist with sprint qualifying? So I'm off topic, but I would love to hear your response to Charles Leclerc's comments. Let's go mine.
No, it's interesting because I've kind of looked and thought about it the way that he said it, because I mean, he's obviously quite positive about it. He seems that he did enjoy the experience, but the one thing I can't really get my mind around is keep the qualifying for both Saturday and the Sunday, which I guess on one hand, it really puts an extra emphasis on qualifying because it's either all or nothing, right? That you either qualify well, and then that's what you're stuck with all weekend long. So I've kind of struggled to maybe get by that. And I could see that, okay, if you qualify bad or you hit traffic, then maybe you're just really out of luck because you're going to be starting, you know, maybe you're hoping for, say, first couple, you know, maybe first two rows, but maybe you're starting now in P10, you know, if you're one of the front runners, for example. So that could be difficult to deal with. But then also, what if you have a mechanical during qualifying? And then, you know, that just to me seems like an extra, I don't want to say punishment, but then it just seems that you don't get that chance to redeem yourself. And unless they go with something that, okay, you qualify, you have your qualifying on Friday, you qualify P1, P20, or somewhere in between, and that's what you go with all weekend long. I thought the only way that you could maybe make that work is perhaps, okay, you have the full-pointed race on Sunday, then maybe the sprint race, instead of sprint qualifying, maybe you have kind of like a mini race. Like we saw, it was like basically one-third distance at Silverstone. Maybe you do like one-third points or something approximate to it. So rather than 25 points for first, you, for the first 10 positions, you go 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, or something like that, right? Or maybe you give out points to the first, to the top five or something like, maybe something like that. Maybe you sweeten the pots in other ways, or I don't know if you get
like
too
it.
Gimmicky. Like,
no, I like
yeah,
it.
I'm just gonna, yeah, I, that part I thought was kind of cool, but then I was thinking, do you want to go as far as like that gimmicky double points thing that they tried a couple of times? You know, I wasn't really a big fan of that when they did that. When was that?
Neither 2015, 2016, or
something like that?
Back in 2014. I like where you're going with this, and it's something that resonates with me in a couple of ways. One, it kind of solves the issues with qualifying, right? Which is, in a sprint qualifying weekend, qualifying is not really qualifying because you don't get pole from qualifying. You just get to start on the front grid for sprint qualifying, but you get the pole for winning the sprint qualifying race, but it's not a race because you can't call it a race because the race is the Grand Prix on Sunday. I like this concept in that you do qualifying on Friday, potentially set the grid for Saturday and Sunday. But I think you're right that if you're going to do qualifying on Friday, which sets the grids for Saturday and Sunday, what's the point of Saturday? Like, you need to make that more meaningful. Mm-hmm. So either there's more points available, or it's a longer race, or it's more intense. So I kind of like that idea of a sprint race. So qualifying sets the grid Saturday and Sunday.
Right.
You have a more meaningful sprint race on the Saturday. And by meaningful, you just mean there's more points available. I kind of like that. And again, this is why I think this concept is so fun, that what we try to at Silverstone was a good start. And certainly it's what's going to be emulated at Monza in a couple of months, but I'm open to some other ideas. And again, I like the idea of a doubleheader. I know realistically from a financial perspective, that's too much, but I like your idea. Like, qualifying on Friday, you get pole. So if you've got tickets for the weekend, you come in on Friday, you have a free practice session on Friday morning, the teams kind of get to a shakedown of the cars. You have qualifying Friday night. Love that at Silverstone. And on Saturday, and maybe because it's a more intense sprint race, maybe you don't do a free practice two session in the morning. Maybe you do. I like that idea of a sprint race that afternoon. It's strictly for points, not to set the grid for Sunday. And then Sunday, you have the Grand Prix, which is the full pointed affair. I like where you're going with this.
Yeah, you know, because I was going back and thinking about the whole sprint qualifying we saw at Silverstone, and I really enjoyed it. But I felt that, what was it? It was 17, 18 laps or something, wasn't it? But I felt that once we got to that about maybe halfway through, maybe two-thirds through that session, it felt that everything was, I don't want to say decided, but it was kind of settling into that groove. And I felt that everybody, it wasn't like they backed off, but everybody kind of felt like, okay, well, we've only got like another five laps to go. It was like, maybe I should just maybe not protect the car, but it wasn't like they were really pushing those last maybe five or six laps. But I thought, well, you know, if Charles is talking about this, maybe we can take a little bit further and then sweeten the pot with these championship points. So all of a sudden you have that, you dangle that incentive of constructors and drivers championship points in front of these guys. And then, yes, okay, we're doing 20 laps, we're doing 15 laps, whatever that that magic number is for that one third race distance or whatever, 100 miles, 100 kilometers, whatever it is, sweeten the pot that way. So that's kind of where we're going with it. Trademark Scuderi F1 podcast. So we'll keep an eye on, see how, you know, who's ripping off our ideas, but all good. All right, so moving ahead, so we'll start this one because I'm sure this one might kind of, well, it'll not kind of, it'll definitely go over into the next segment as well. But according to Toto Wolff, he believes Formula One should expect that further crashes and accidents between Lewis Hamilton and Max Verstappen is pretty much a done deal. It's going to be expected unless they do not resume their on-track rivalry in a sportsmanlike manner. So here we are, 10 days out, almost 2 weeks out from that big crash that they had with the two of them at Silverstone last weekend. And apparently, tempers is probably cooled, but emotions still obviously seem to be a little bit on edge. Let's put it that way.
Absolutely. We got plenty of questions this week. And I think one of our mailbag questions, which we'll probably speak to later in the show, pertained specifically to this, which is, can we anticipate that there's possibly going to be more contact between these drivers as the season goes on? And is this a normal part of Formula One? Because I think that's a question for a lot of folks in that, hey, I'm new to Formula One this year, or I was new to Formula One last year. And a lot of what I was seeing was difficult to process. It was difficult to absorb. But now that I'm more in tune with the sport and I saw a contact and I saw a crash and I saw somebody's race compromised because of it, I want to understand if this is new. I think ultimately contact isn't ideal, and it's certainly not the reason that we watch this sport. And certainly contact isn't ingrained in the sport as part of competitiveness as it might be in stock car racing. but it's going to happen if you have equally matched drivers who are navigating extremely technical or high speed corners at high rates of speed, and they in their head have to make millions of calculations in a split second. Mistakes will happen. There will be contact. They'll misjudge corners. They'll misjudge the condition of their tires, the heat in their brakes. Contact's going to happen. And that's not necessarily a bad thing if it's unintentional or if it's not flagrant or if it's not negligent. It's just a byproduct of close racing, and that's okay. We haven't seen a lot of this in recent years because there hasn't been a tremendous amount of close racing at the front of the field. And really, the last time that we saw a razor-thin margin between two drivers was 2016, mm-hmm. between two teammates, Nico Rosberg and Lewis Hamilton. And there was a lot of contact between those two drivers. If you're not familiar, go and Google the 2016 Spanish Grand Prix right now. You only have to watch the first three or four corners of that lap to see what I'm talking about. But that wasn't even the peak of the mountain in terms of the combativeness and competitiveness between those two drivers. There was plenty of contact. So it's a part of the sport. Emotions boil over. Sometimes there's miscalculations when you enter a corner, exit a corner, when you're looking to overtape, when you're measuring the toe. It happens. It's just a part of the sport. And I don't want to dismiss it as being insignificant from a safety perspective, but it's just a natural part of the sport when you have two highly competitive drivers racing equally matched cars at high rates of speed.
Yeah, totally. And I love that you use the word boil, because you can't really compare the situation between Hamilton and Rosberg that you can with Hamilton and Verstappen, because obviously, like you pointed out there, the situation now is between two rival teams. Before, it was two rivals within a team, but where it is different between these two, and I mean, obviously, where they are similar is it's Hamilton competing in the championship directly with either Nico Rosberg or Max Verstappen. So now it's just like, where's that challenge coming? Is it internal or external? Right. But the thing is that, relatively speaking, that Lewis and Nico, that was a slow burn, the way that situation really got to the point where it was volatile. We had the situation in Spa in 2015, I think it was, then there was Austria, then there was Spain in 2016. There's a whole bunch of them. I mean, you don't even have to search too much to see how many incidents that these guys had, plus the fact that there was this really toxic relationship between them. And I always love, if you go back and listen to the race radio, because it was never, well, how is Lewis doing or how's Nico doing? It's always, where's the other car? It's like they got to the point that they couldn't even speak each other's names out loud. Now,
yeah, that's so true.
Yeah, and then, you know, but if you look at the rivalry that Max and Lewis have, sure, Max and Lewis, they've been racing against each other, but although Max has won some races here and there over the past couple of seasons, they were, I wouldn't say unexpected, but they were certainly not the norm, just considering how dominant that Mercedes has been over the past number of years. But so when you see now that this year that there is a very, very small gap in between these two cars, and it really comes down to almost who's got the better car, who's just on it on any given Sunday, is that this situation between the two of them has basically come to a boil very, very quickly. We saw a little bit, Bahrain was a little bit different because Max kind of backed out of it. He ran wide. He had to back off. He had to give the position back. And then we saw a little bit of contact on the opening lap at Imola a week or two later. And then Lewis Locke, I think he lost a little bit off the end plate on his front wing. And then we've seen it kind of go back and forth. Lewis has been dominant or better at some tracks, and Max has been better at others. And then all of a sudden, almost kind of out of nowhere, that did this incident come. And like you say, I mean, it was hard racing. It was close racing between two very good drivers, neither of whom were going to back off and give the other guy an inch more than they needed to.
I think you did a really good job of summarizing how we got to this point, but I don't know that it should necessarily be a surprise in terms of what we saw, because you're right. And I think the term that the media kept using through the first couple months of the season was these great drivers are showing each other so much respect. And by showing each other respect, what they were referring to is they were giving each other space on track when normally they might not. And I think part of that was it was early in the season and they were still feeling each other out and they were still feeling out each other's cars and they were feeling out their own cars and getting familiar with the setup and all of those different kind of things. But I also don't think either of the drivers at that point in the season wanted to make an aggressive move that could result in contact and compromise their own race. But I think we're at that point in the season now where, one, Max feels he could potentially put his foot on Lewis's throat in terms of the championship itself, in terms of points accumulation. And I think Lewis, likewise, is feeling the opposite, which is potentially getting away from me, and now is no longer the time to show each other respect on the track. And some of those moves that maybe we weren't making earlier in the season, it's time to start making some of these more aggressive moves that I feel confident in being able to do. So you're right, it's been building to this moment. And I think what we saw at Silverstone was really exacerbated by the fact that Hamilton does a fantastic job in qualifying. He doesn't have a great start at the sprint qualifying event. He's very upset with himself going into Saturday, felt he let himself down with the wheel spin off the start, felt he let down the British fans. And I think if ever he wasn't going to let the championship get away from him, it's in front of 140,000 people at a track he's won at 7 or 8 times previous. The other thought I had too, and I don't want to go too far off track because we always get slandered for this, but you make a great point about Nico and Lewis. And I really wonder in hindsight what that battle would have been like if they were on different teams. Do you know what I mean? Like, I wonder how much of that venom was actually being suppressed by Toto and how much internal damage he has to his internal organs for like jumping on the grenade that was that relationship for so many years. And that one was unique too, because if you remember, Nico was there since the inception of the Mercedes team. He was there with Schumacher. He was there when Hamilton was recruited over by Lauda. He saw Lewis storm out to a win in 14, despite the fact that it kind of came down to the final double points finish in Abu Dhabi. 2015, Lewis ran away with the championship, but Nico won the last 3 races. And then in 2016, Nico won the first 4 to start. But obviously that relationship is very, very different than the Lewis-Max one because they were teammates, which is also one of the really interesting things about Formula One. But anyways, let's get back on track before we get slandered too bad.
Well, anyways, I think this is a good place to leave it for another break because I want to pick up another aspect of this whole situation. We'll do so on the other side. But
I had a tease as well. You did? Can I do the tease on the next commercial?
You can do the tease on the next commercial. But as we go into the break here, I just want to read a comment from Nigel Velli in the live chat and he had to say, best part of the red flag was watching Mercedes fix Lewis's front wing with duct tape and super glue. There's nothing like a multi-billion-dollar sport fixing a multi-million-dollar car with $10 worth of supplies you can get at Home Depot.
So true. So
there you go. Anyways, time for a quick break here. We will be back in just a moment. So guys, don't go away. We have got a lot more to talk about and we'll do so in just a moment.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
All right. Well, welcome back to the show. You are listening to the podcast is always up to speed with Formula One with Mr.'s Mark Daly and Hamilton, the Marks as we've commonly be known or addressed nowadays, which is pretty cool and easy for everybody, might I add. Now, before the break, we were talking about that incident. I know we're going to get hammered for it because, well, I mean, everybody else is talking about it. So we're just doing the same thing and just not being original. Anyways, Christian Horner, team principal of Red Bull, said that they are still considering FIA action over the $1.8 million of damage sustained to Max Verstappen's 51G impact into the barrier at Copse Corner last weekend. Christian had to say, quote, "It is no secret that we felt at the time and still feel that Hamilton was given a light penalty for this type of incident. Given the severity of the incident and the lenient penalty, we are reviewing all the data and have the right to request a review. We are therefore still looking at the evidence and considering all of our sporting options," end quote. So they cannot directly appeal the 10-second time penalty that Lewis was given. They are able to request a review of the case of the incident by the FAA as long as they can bring, and this is the key, quote, "significant and relevant," end quote, "new pieces of evidence to light to argue their case within 14 days. So, talk about pressure. If you've been that team within the factory at Milton Keynes that has been told by probably Marco, told by Christian Horner and probably Max, you know, go find something. We need to find something that proves our case that we can press this. Then I'm sure there's a lot of sleepless nights of people poring over data and telemetry and God only knows what else. But I think ultimately it goes back to what we talked about at the time is just I really don't know what they can expect for an outcome. Should they be able to take this? I mean, obviously it's a huge thing because it's, you know, we've got the cost cap in place, obviously, and a $1.8 million repair bill in a $140 million cost cap is big, big, big money and very significant.
I completely agree. I think the question ultimately for Christian Horner and the rest of the Milton Keynes team and their executives is this the hill you want to die on?
Right.
Is this the hill that you want to battle on until the end? Is this the incident that is worth compromising? And I don't want to be too dramatic here, but to go to the FIA and to effectively say that the stewards were wrong and the penalty wasn't harsh enough and that we've done 2 weeks of Sherlock-level investigation and we've found some ounce of data that suggests that this was flagrant or intentional is problematic for a couple of reasons. Because first and foremost, it sets a precedent. And it sets the precedence that every time there could be an incident like this, that the teams could go to the FIA and present data and litigate these situations in the court of public opinion at the FIA and potentially in the jurisdiction of the legal courts. This isn't a good look for Formula One. It's not a good look for Red Bull. And I think one of the things that I continue to see are former race car drivers, former Formula One drivers coming forward and saying, look, this is a racing incident. And we've heard executives that are currently with Formula One teams saying, this was a racing incident. Hamilton was at fault. If we need to assign blame, no question at all. He took a penalty. The stewards awarded a penalty. He took it. He won the race. We move on. If you're angry at the penalty, have that conversation with the stewards. And it's funny because a couple of months ago, my friend, even a month ago, I had people sending us DMs saying, it disgusts me that you two are such big homers for Red Bull. I'm never going to listen to your show again. And then a week ago, I had the exact same messaging, not necessarily from the same people, saying, you guys are just gigantic Mercedes fanboys. And like, let us be very clear here. We want nothing more. I love Lewis. I love Max. I love Charles Leclerc. I don't think there's really many drivers on the current grid that I don't love. All I want to see is a competitive championship.
Yeah.
But the more I've reviewed that footage and come to understand the situation and listen to people weigh in and share their opinion, to me, it was a racing incident. Hamilton was at fault. He was assigned a penalty. That's great. He served his penalty. They didn't litigate that, but I don't think it's a good look for Christian Horner and Red Bull to continue to litigate this in the court of public opinion, because unless they have some smoking bullet, some piece of evidence that suggests that there was something borderline criminal happening with Lewis Hamilton and the Mercedes team, this isn't a good look. Because what my fear is you create a precedence where if you're a big team and you have the resources to litigate these things, you're going to litigate every single piece of contact on the track. And here's the other consideration. What if they go to the FIA and they battle this out, and in a month from now, we come back at Spa, and what if Max goes into a corner hot and makes a mistake and takes out Hamilton? Then what? It's challenging, because what you're suggesting here is we are perfect and we don't make mistakes and our drivers don't make mistakes and Hamilton was at fault. I don't like how this is how this is trending. What do you think? What are your feelings?
Yeah, you know, I totally agree. I mean, it's problematic. I really don't know what they can do or expect. I mean, I can understand. I mean, yeah, you've basically written off a car. It's almost $2 million and $140 million cost cap. So obviously it's significant because the penalty doesn't fit the, you know, the crime basically, right? I mean, 10 seconds for $2 million worth of damage. I can understand why they're really salty and upset about it for sure. But, you know, I'm going to be a little bit silly now. I mean, I was just going to say that Liberty would never let it go that far, because if it actually goes to legal action, you know, they're savvy enough and smart enough that if it has to go to like legal proceedings, I'm sure they'll get the People's Court or Judge Judy or somebody involved and get some entertainment
but
value.
Knowing Liberty, maybe they could turn it into a special.
Yeah, maybe, right? But it's just problematic for so many things or so many ways. Going back to a more serious note, it's just like, exactly, we could see something further down the road, pun intended, that Max is on the wrong side of it. And it just gets to the point that, where do you want to draw that line in the sand? Where do you want to set that precedent? And I think that's where it becomes very, very tricky. And I mean, we've had this discussion quite a bit over the last couple of weeks, not just us, but just in the Formula One sphere in general, just about the regulation, about the, I guess, all the parameters that are going into the new cars, right? And then you'll get some comments, okay, if they start, you know, you take some sort of action against that move by Lewis Hamilton, it's like, well, they're regulating what they do with the cars, now they're regulating more what they do in the cars, and then that's where it goes. But anyways, I think another one of the comments in the live chat is pretty on point, and is again from Nigevelli, who says that's exactly where Red Bull is lobbying. It's not for this incident, it's to get some sort of beneficial ruling for the next one, perhaps. Maybe it's just an awareness campaign, which I think is a very interesting twist.
Unless that next incident is facilitated by Max Verstappen. And I think that's the risk, right? Is you're projecting this image that your drivers are free of error, free of mistake. And that might not necessarily be the case next time these drivers or these two tremendous racers are going toe-to-toe in every single corner on the first lap.
Yeah, exactly, right? Very interesting. All right, well, let's move on to the next one. And this is one that you sent me that was some of the takeaways, I think, that were very interesting from the British Grand Prix and the storylines going into the Hungarian Grand Prix on Sunday. So I'll let you take this one away, since this is your thing. Is this what you're going to tease at before the break, or you got something else?
No, I've got... Are we ready for a break?
No, not yet. I've got a couple more minutes anyways.
Okay. So, yeah, I think, because I got a few stories here, I want to make sure I've got the right story here. This one right here. So I think there's a couple of thoughts when we go into Hungary, and there's a couple of stories that I kind of want to touch on here real quick. One, I think the thing that we didn't necessarily talk enough about coming out of Silverstone, because one of the kind of the knock-on effects or the downstream impacts of the fact that there was that contact between Max Verstappen and between Lewis Hamilton is we didn't necessarily give Ferrari and Charles Leclerc necessarily the shine that they deserve for that performance. And, you know, it was only 6 months ago, 8 months ago, 10 months ago, where you and I were sitting here and we would regularly discuss the total lack of performance from that Ferrari team. So to backtrack, so everyone has a little bit of context, if you look in 2017, Ferrari had a competitive package, they couldn't bring it together. 2018, they had a competitive package, but there was a lot of driver errors, there was a lot of strategy mistakes, and there's some frustration there. 2019, everything seemed to be going well from a performance perspective. They had the fastest car in the grid, the fastest top end, their aero seemed to be dialed in. There was unquestionably a lot of conflict between their two drivers, in the sense that Charles Leclerc made the move over from Alfa Romeo and he was instantly outperforming Sebastian Vettel. And early in the season, it looked like Ferrari had these designs on the fact that Charles Leclerc was going to be kind of the 1B driver to Sebastian Vettel. There'd be team orders. Initially, Charles kind of pushed back on that, and then Sebastian pushed back on that, and there was a lot of conflict. But ultimately, the two drivers, especially Charles, was putting together a pretty good season. Last year was a total disaster for the team from a performance perspective. One, because the aero design that they brought didn't necessarily match the power that their power unit was providing, because they were down 50 horsepower, an estimated 50 horsepower, because the FIA had ruled that they were doing some questionable things from a software engine control perspective. But I think one of the things that we probably haven't acknowledged enough of is how effectively this team has rebounded this year. And I'll be very honest, if that contact between Lewis and Max had happened two laps later, let's say that crash had happened on lap three, Ferrari could have won a Grand Prix at an extremely demanding track. So I think that's probably something worth noting. And a lot of people have reached out to me over the course of the last week asking specifically that question, which is, was that a great performance? Should we be excited about this? Why aren't they getting enough shine? And honestly, like, admittedly, shame on us, because I don't think we necessarily gave enough love to Charles and the Ferrari team for the performance they put in that weekend. And I also want to credit Charles as well, because while he wasn't necessarily able to hold on to the lead at the end of that Grand Prix, he was extraordinarily gracious in second place on that podium. And obviously, I don't think he was expecting to be in a position to win a podium, period. But I think Ferrari certainly deserves some credit, because based on some of their performances this year, I think they've made significantly more progress in 2021 than I had imagined. I thought this was going to be very much a repeat of the previous campaign, and kudos to that team for being able to put together some really great performances.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you just nailed it that when you said that you didn't really expect them to be this competitive, because you're not the only one. I don't want to say that I'd written them off, but my expectations for this team, not just last year, but this year and maybe next year, for the foreseeable, like, short to midterm, was really dialed back. I mean, this is comes from the comments basically from up and down through the ranks at the team, that from all levels, that were basically saying, well, we don't really expect to be competitive until 2022, maybe not even until 2023. So I think it's a really great story, because the one thing that we've seen in his relatively short time in Formula One is just how exciting of a driver Charles Leclerc really, really is. And I think that it would really add a real wrinkle, a real twist to the championship, even though he might not be a legitimate contender to the title himself. But could you imagine? Okay, we have two teams now that are very capable, obviously, of winning a race any given Sunday, and Red Bull and Mercedes. But how great would that be for the sport? How great would that be for parity if Ferrari all of a sudden got their act together and had this competitive car, this car that is able to win races, and all of a sudden you've almost got like this three-horse race that between the big three, any one of those teams is able to win a race on any given Sunday, because we know Lewis can win, we know Valtteri can win, we know Max can win, we know that Sergio can win, we know that Charles can win. And you got to think that Carlos Sainz is probably fancying his chances after coming so close at Monza last year. So I think that's it's a real tantalizing thing. And it's one of those situations where Ferrari, I think they need Formula One, and Formula One needs Ferrari. I know when you say that about basically any other team, that percentage is weighed one way or another to varying degrees. But I think Ferrari, just based on their stature, I mean, I think it's still beneficial for both of them to be in the sports. And I think that Ferrari could walk away if they wanted to, but it would be a big loss for them. It'd be a big loss for the sport. And it's also not good for the team or for the sport in general, for Formula One, if Ferrari struggles. I mean, your most iconic race team in the entire world that's been there since day one.
Absolutely. No question. I think the best possible outcome to this Formula One season would somehow be for Lando Norris to come up the middle and split between Max and Lewis and win a championship. I think that storyline would be made into movies, into miniseries. I think you could do an 8-part documentary on Netflix just about that. But I think one of the things that could be potentially compelling, because you're right in the sense that during the 7-year V6 turbo hybrid era, we've had some level of dominance, obviously, from Mercedes every single year. And then we've had some degree of competitiveness between Red Bull and Ferrari. Until this year, Red Bull's never really been this close, and Ferrari had a couple of good years, 2019 until it fell apart, and even then Vettel was pretty inconsistent. Mm-hmm. 2018, they had the car, they didn't necessarily have the right people driving those cars, and there was a ton of strategy mistakes from the pit wall. But this year's interesting because even though there's really only two teams that at this point could compete for the championship, you effectively have four teams that could meaningfully compete for a podium every single race. Yeah. And I think one of the things that we were reminded of last weekend is the fact that McLaren is no longer the preordained third place team in the Constructors' Championship this year. That could potentially be a really compelling battle between McLaren and Ferrari, and something we should talk more about as the season progresses. And I had a listener actually send me some Italian newspaper articles earlier this week, and he's like, look, Ferrari may be saying, they might be saying outwardly that they're really focused on 2022, but internally, and I went and translated these through Google Translate because I had no idea what they said, but they were very clear that at least in the Italian press, Ferrari was very clear that they saw third place as their baseline and nothing else would be acceptable this year. So as much as they're building towards 2022, based on the car and the driver lineup that they brought into the season, they had much more lofty expectations than maybe we understood they did. And you look at the championship so far this year, if not for the fact that Charles Leclerc couldn't get onto the front row at Monaco because of that DNF, they may have that 15 points that kind of separate the two teams right now. They still have two podium finishes this year, and obviously McLaren has three, but there have been two second place finishes. So I think there's something to be said for the battle between those two teams.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, Mark, let's take another break here. When we come back on the other side, couple more stories and then we'll jump into the mailbag. And oh, hey, I'm raining on your parade, sort of, I guess, kind of. But you said you wanted to tease something. So please tease away.
Let's tease this. Coming up after the break, this famous North American athlete, who might be very familiar to NFL fans, has a few things to say about Formula One. That and much more coming up after the break.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
All right. Well, welcome back. Well, I accuse you of being a professional, Mr. Hamilton. That was very nicely done there on the front end of the break there. So you can't tease that and not pick it up right away. So you've my ears have really pricked up here. I want to find out who that was.
And it's only because I listened to Greeny and Golic on ESPN radio driving to work for like 5 years that I got used to their ultimate commercial teasers. But this is a tweet, and I actually missed the tweet, but then our Twitter mailbox just filled with people that were sending this to us. We had people from sports radio and from some of these other big sports websites that were sending this to us. A bunch of our listeners sent it to us. But JJ Watt posted this earlier today. Cool. Didn't know a single thing about Formula One racing besides Lewis Hamilton until like a month ago. Now I'm just wondering which is greater, Christian Horner's love for Max Verstappen or his hate for Toto Wolff. I'm also down a deep rabbit hole on the 2022 car and the downforce implications. This was fantastic. So this just talked,
that's
and I
really
don't want to overreact, and I'm the king of hyperbole, but when you have an extremely popular North American NFL player or American NFL player tweeting about his passion, his newfound passion and conversion into Formula One fandom, I think that's ultimately pretty cool. And of course, a bunch of the teams tweeted at him. The F1 Twitter account actually tweeted at him as well, to which he responded and said he's trying to learn more about the downforce and the floors for next year. But pretty exciting that there seem to be so many mainstream converts, right? And for somebody that isn't an NFL or isn't necessarily an F1 fan, but they're a fan of JJ Watt, to see this tweet, maybe that results in a Google search, or maybe they watch a Grand Prix, or maybe they go to YouTube to see what's happening. But yeah, pretty cool. And it wasn't necessarily what I was expecting to see from JJ Watt, who I like. I don't know a ton about him because I'm not necessarily a big NFL fan, because I just don't have the bandwidth or the headspace to take on the commitment of another sport. But very, very, very cool to say, none the least, and to 27 people that tweeted this at us. Thank you very, very much. Because I would never have seen it if you didn't bring it to my attention.
Yeah, you know what? Actually, it's pretty cool. When you get a guy like J.J. Watt stand up and say something like that, I mean, it has a bit more significance because, I mean, he's a household name. I mean, he's one of these people, like an athlete, that you might not be a hardcore NFL fan, but chances are you know who he is or you know the name. So that's pretty cool. I wonder if that might parlay itself into some sort of celebrity appearance. I know that the U.S. Grand Prix is kind of right in the middle of like NFL season, but who knows? Maybe on a Thursday or a Friday or something.
He just stamped his ticket to COTA. What, you absolutely nailed it. What is the bet he will be in a paddock? Or he probably got 10 different invites from the teams today. But I think you're absolutely right. Like, I'm looking at the guy's Twitter account right now. 5.6 million followers.
Yeah.
I guarantee there's almost zero overlap with existing F1 fans. So potentially 5 million people who don't know anything about Formula One saw that tweet today. And if 1% of those, if 2% of 5% of those did a Google search and just looked into it, what a great way to start converting new fans.
Oh yeah. Well, can you imagine, you know, if you see a picture of him on Twitter, on Instagram or something like that, rocking a Mercedes hat or... a Ferrari hat or something like that, you know, his followers are going to pick up on that. And that's great marketing for Formula One.
So I guess that's ultimately the question, right? Which is, he's going to be at COTA. You just nailed it. He's going to be in a garage. I guess the question is, which team will, it won't be Haas. At least I hope it's not going to be Haas. But I guess the question is, which team will, which team's invite will excite him the most?
Well, that's the thing though, right? I mean, a guy like JJ Watt, I mean, he's kind of like your top tier NFL personality, celebrity, athlete, whatever you want to call it. So, I mean, he's probably going to, if he gets an invite, I mean, he's probably going to think about his own personal branding and things like that. So, I mean, chances are that if he does show up, I would expect it's probably at one of the you know, the top end teams. Let's put it that way. I mean, I think if you're a guy like JJ, you'd love to have that association, even if it's just for a day with Ferrari or Mercedes or whatever, right? I mean, that would be pretty darn cool. Anyways,
so I bet you didn't think we'd spend 7 minutes talking about an NFL player tonight.
No, I love it. I love the NFL. I'm a big football fan, so anytime that we can make that that crossover, I think that's really, really cool. I wanted to, maybe I'll just shelve this one because we're already coming up in an hour. I know we got a pretty full mailbag. This next story, I'm going to just put that in for, move that till Thursday night. So this one, I think I just want to talk because this is a little bit more of what I would call an evergreen discussion. And this is Toto Wolff making the comment that the Mercedes Formula E driver deserved to be in Formula One amid some of the talks and links that are being drawn to their names with be potentially an open seat at Williams Racing, because we're all expecting at some point that seat currently occupied by Valtteri Bottas is going to be made vacant and will be shortly filled by Mr. George Russell.
It's interesting, and I think this story and ultimately Toto's talking about a couple of younger Mercedes drivers such as Nyck de Vries and Stoffel Van Dorn, I think it reflects the fact that Mercedes has this seemingly strong pipeline of talent that comes into Formula One, and then all of a sudden there's this real bottleneck as soon as you get past Formula 3, Formula 2, and that bottleneck is really the byproduct of the fact that they don't have a really strong relationship with any other teams other than Williams in terms of taking on some of this younger talent for developmental purposes. So Williams ends up in this awkward position where if they're comfortable with their driver lineup at their Mercedes team, they don't really have anywhere else to stash these drivers. And obviously one of the huge foundational things that's been so successful for Red Bull, though I think we could argue ad nauseum about whether it's really been successful since Daniel Ricciardo left or not, is at least in the Red Bull case, that team went out of its way to buy a competitor and transform them into their top tier development program. Mm-hmm. So ultimately we can develop drivers at the academy level. And really when you talk about an academy, it's different than soccer where you have a physical academy and you bring your players there and you test them and you drill them and you put them through exercises and you familiarize them with your programs and your philosophies. In Motorsports is a little bit different in the sense that you identify these young talents and you sign them early and you help cover the costs of bringing them through karting and the lower formulas, because without sponsorship, it's impossible. So if you get an academy deal with a Ferrari or Red Bull or Mercedes, they help to subsidize the cost of bringing you through that development pathway. The challenge is really, once you get to that Formula One level, if you've been successful and you've graduated through the academy and you've been successful in F3 and F2, ultimately, if that team doesn't have a seat for you, you're kind of stuck. And that's ultimately where George Russell is, in the sense that he's now been with the Williams team for 3 years. It's becoming increasingly clear, or maybe even obvious, that Mercedes has designs on putting him into that Mercedes seat. But really, he's only with Williams because Williams was desperately in need of a driver to fill that second seat. And no doubt Mercedes monetarily made it worth their while. But whereas Red Bull has this second team to stash their drivers, help develop them at the highest tier and get them familiar with F1 levels of grip and braking and acceleration and tracks, Mercedes doesn't have that benefit, but they still have great talent. And I think one of the things that was really frustrating recently is that we were able to see people like Nikita Mazepin graduate into Formula One, despite not necessarily being deserving of the ride, yet other F2 champions, or an F2 champion like Nyck de Vries, is kind of wasting away in Formula E. And I'm not trying to slander or take a shot at Formula E, but ultimately this is a guy who won the Formula 2 championship. He did everything that could possibly have been asked for him at the highest level of open wheel racing outside of Formula 1. And he stashed away in Formula E just because Mercedes has nowhere to put him. And I don't necessarily have an answer for this, but maybe the answer is more teams, whether they're linked to Mercedes or owned by Mercedes. I think ultimately there's more space on the grid for additional teams, because I just think there's some really talented drivers outside of the sport that deserve a ride. And I think as long as some of these teams are going to depend on pay drivers, some of these other great drivers aren't going to get a ride. So whether it's Mercedes buying a team or whether it becomes more attractive for other teams to join the grid, I just think there's more room. And I think a 12-team, 24-car grid would be fantastic for Formula One, because some of these other young kids would get a ride.
Cue the discussion for the third team car that's sort of percolate up into the consciousness every couple of years here and there. But, you know, another name that, I mean, you make some great points about Nyck de Vries, but another guy that is very interesting to talk about is from the reserve driver, Mercedes reserve driver, that is Stoffel Vandoorne, obviously one of the Mercedes FE drivers. And he's one of those guys that just kind of got his break into Formula One at exactly the wrong moment, because he got into Formula One right at the point where McLaren were at their lowest point, both on and off the track. It was just a shambles. The team wasn't really being run. The car wasn't great. Honda was struggling with the power or the power unit. And it was just a tough run for him, and he just didn't really have anywhere to go. He was never going to do anything. I mean, if he came into the team now with the car that they have now compared to what they had in 2015 or 2016, whatever it was when he came in. Well, when did he get his debut with the team? It was when Fernando had that big crash in Australia in 2015, missed Bahrain. Stoffel debuts for him to cover for that race in Bahrain.
Scored in the points.
Exactly.
The points.
Exactly. Yep. By the point, pun intended, I wanted to make. Is that
that's
quite all right. I mean, it's great because he came in basically out of the cold and then scored a point on his debut in a car that he wasn't necessarily familiar with, and then he gets a full-time drive with the car at their, you know, like their worst possible point. So, you know, I think that obviously was unfortunate in terms of timing for his career, but there's always been some question marks for me regarding Stoffel Vandoorne. I mean, how old is he now? He must be, what, 25, 26, thereabouts?
29.
So 29, wow.
Yeah, so he's one. I think you're a big, also, I'm just going to throw this out there, so allegations, but I think you like him because he's Belgian.
He's Belgian. I'm Dutch. We don't necessarily get along with the Belgians so much, but for some weird reason, I never really understood, other than that's just the way it's always been. So, you know, biases.
Okay. Wild allegation, proven false. But I think he started a little bit later. So he was very much, I think, a Nicholas Latifi in terms of kind of graduating to those higher levels.
Right.
But at the same time, you're right. Like 2016, that was itself 5.5 years ago. And then he raced 2017, 2018. And you're absolutely right. He was in the worst place at the worst time. I think everything associated with McLaren at that time, from the power unit to the leadership in the team to Ron Dennis, it all had to go. Unfortunately, I think he was just guilty by association, right? Whether he had the talent or not, he was in the wrong place at the wrong time. And then I think ultimately by the time he finished his run with McLaren, so he finished out the 2018 season. So he raced two full calendars with that team, 17, 18. But I think by the time he was done, I think he had a couple things going against him, which is one, he'd been with a really poor team, hadn't put in any really competitive drives. He had a couple of seventh place finishes in 17, if I remember correctly, and four points finishes in 2018. But ultimately, I just think he had too much going against him. And I think one of the challenges too is at that point, he was also an older driver, and any team looking to bring somebody on was probably looking for a younger talent.
Yeah, totally. And I think maybe just to clarify, I would say that I am a fan of Stoffel Vandoorne, basically from the points that you just raised, the unfulfilled potential, just that he showed some glimpses of when he was in Formula One, but ultimately, I think now at 29, that's perhaps maybe not, but he seems a little bit too old to really sort of get a long-term shot in Formula One. You would think that if they're looking to bring anybody up that through the system to maybe work their way into the Mercedes team at some point, you would think that youth might have the advantage, but who knows? But I do think it is interesting nonetheless that Toto is bringing their names up. I mean, they're two very good drivers, no doubt about it. And I guess basically what he is saying is there's more to this discussion than perhaps any of us had really thought.
It is interesting, too, that this conversation does also highlight Mercedes's involvement with Formula E, right? In the sense that they have a team at Formula E, at least they have somewhere to put some of these former Academy drivers, if not for the Formula E circuit itself and the fact that Mercedes had a team. Nick DeVries might be with another organization altogether. He might be in DTM. He might be trying his hand at Indy. So at least through Formula E, they have some degree of control over his development and the trajectory of his career. But again, if I had a choice between the two of them, and I know that's not necessarily where we got started on this one, given that Stoffel's 29, he's had two full championships to kind of demonstrate what his capabilities are. And given the fact that he's on the wrong side of 25, I would certainly give Nick DeVries a shot. He won the Formula 2 championship just a couple of years ago. I think he would be my preference, but he himself isn't particularly young either. This is a kid that's 26, and people criticize Latifi for being a little bit older relative to some of his peers, but Nick DeVries himself is a little bit on the older side, but I would certainly give him a shot, and I would love to see him find his way into Formula One over the course of the next couple of years.
Yeah, absolutely. But very interesting, and I guess we're going to be watching this one over the summer break to see if anything transpires with that Mercedes seat at any point. But we'll see. There'll be plenty to talk about, no doubt.
Oh, I am, and I tweeted about this, and we don't need to get into this now, but I am absolutely confident. I am absolutely 100% confident that Mercedes will announce their driver lineup for 2022 during the summer break. I think partly it will be because they want to cut out the back end speculation that could become a massive distraction during the back half of the season. But I think what they're potentially want to do is make sure that if Bottas isn't coming back for 2022, that in alignment with the announcement for who his replacer is going to be, part of the announcement will be that they found a ride for Bottas as well, because I don't think they want to be in a position where, hey, we announced George Russell for 2022, and then you've got poor Bottas finishing out the back half of the calendar, uncertain of where he's going to be and all those questions surrounding him. And we obviously saw Toto make comments recently about the fact that he'll do everything in his power to help Bottas find a ride. So I think if you start putting all these things together, I think it's pretty clear that announcement will come during the summer break. And if it does, then it's good for Mercedes because their future is clear. Those questions stop getting asked and they can focus on the championship. And I think all of that's just predicated on their ability to find a ride for Valtteri. Although that also is predicated on the fact that Hamilton himself is okay with bringing Russell in and pairing with him, especially considering he's made so many glowing comments about what a great teammate Bottas has been recently. But
yeah, exactly.
We can save that for another day.
Absolutely. So one final break when we come back, tweets and emails the rest of the way. So don't go away. We're going to do that in just a moment.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why? And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Okay, welcome back. Yes, it is that time. It is Mailbag Monday. So, well, before we open up the Twitter mailbox and go into the email box, I'm just going to read the first one here from Devin Rance. It says, "Hey guys, I took your advice and watched Rush. Holy crap, that was good. Thanks for the recommendation, Devin." So, yeah, if you guys haven't watched it, go check out Netflix or Amazon Prime, wherever it is. It's not too hard to find. Definitely a good watch and a fun movie to take in.
I think it's on Prime right now.
Is it on Prime right now? I know it was on Netflix not too long ago, but certainly a good one to take in, especially over the summer break when you need some Formula One for your Jones. All right, next one. Let's go to Twitter, Mark.
Yeah, so here's a question that I love. This one, it kind of builds on this reoccurring theme that we've had from a lot of our listeners. And again, if you don't know, I think proportionately the bulk of our listeners and the community are based out of the US, which is exciting for us because we get to have these conversations to relate F1 back to North American sports and help nurture this new audience. But one of the questions that comes up quite often, and this was a tweet that came to us a couple of days ago from Ben Nasta, is, and I quote, "Hey guys, love the show. With the rapid growth of F1 in the US and incoming cost certainties, which is the cost cap, those kind of things, what do you think the odds are of an American manufacturer coming in, investing in, or outright buying Haas, thinking General Motors through the Corvette brand or possibly Ford? I think the time is right for somebody to jump in right as the sport is changing, exploding over here." So exploding in the sense of popularity, TV ratings, interest, and all those different kinds of exciting measures of success. But I'll pass this one over to your thoughts. So really, it's the question is, do we foresee, do we anticipate another American manufacturer getting involved, possibly with a new team, an expansion team, to parlay an expression that our North American listeners might be more familiar with, or possibly buying out Gene, which I think all of us would be excited to see at this point?
You know, I find it a little bit sort of mind-boggling to think that a country like America, where there is no doubt the contributions that American people and American industry have made to the automotive industry and the love affair that that Americans have with anything that rolls on 1, 2, 3, 4, or as many wheels as possible, that it seems so strange that that there isn't a bigger party besides Gene Haas involved in Formula One running a team, be it Ford, be it GM, be it whoever, right? So I think unless somebody kind of gets in and maybe is a little bit proactive, I'm kind of wondering, let's put it this way, if say one of the big manufacturers gets on board, I'm kind of wondering that it might be something that's reactive rather than proactive, that let's put it this way, that the decision might be made for them in terms of all of a sudden you see all these people rocking Mercedes merch and Ferrari merch and everybody's talking about, hey, did you watch Ferrari and Mercedes fighting out on a Sunday? And then you're thinking, okay, you're an executive at Ford or GM or whatever, and you're thinking, well, you know, this is the biggest racing series in the world. It's exploding here at home stateside. We're not in it. And all these people in our primary market in America are walking around wearing t-shirts and hats of German car companies or Japanese car companies. So I'm kind of wondering from there, but I'm kind of interested too at the email that we had from Diego last week, who is the machinist at Roush Engineering, and whether, you know, that there's some possibility that maybe that they do something in Formula One similar that they're doing in NASCAR. There's so many possibilities, and I'm just not sure. I mean, Ford's most recent adventure in Formula One really didn't turn out Jaguar. All that great, yeah, with Jaguar. So, you know, it's it's so tantalizing, and it's one of those things that you would think would be a bit of a no-brainer, but I'm just not really sure who would be bold enough to do it right now. That's basically where I'm at with it right now. I don't know what you think.
I have a couple of thoughts on this. One, it's a great question, and I think it's tantalizing to think about, and I think you did a really great job of summarizing this, which is, historically, why would a North American manufacturer get involved with Formula One? The reality is, your principal market is the United States. A lot of these domestic manufacturers aren't big into the export market, and if they are, they're using sub-brands. So historically, General Motors uses different brands globally to cater to all of its different markets. Sure. So if you brand a Formula One team General Motors, you're going to have limited appeal outside of the US. And then ultimately, if you only had one race in the US or zero races in the US, where's your domestic ROI going to come from? It makes sense to partner up and launch NASCAR teams when you race 15, 20, 25 times a year annually, and they're all in the US in front of US audiences and in front of US TVs and all that kind of stuff. But from a Formula One perspective, historically, it's never made sense for a big American company to become involved. And we've seen Toyota get involved, and that made sense because it's a global brand. And we've seen BMW get involved, and that makes sense because they're a global brand, and Mercedes is a global brand. But if you look at these domestic brands, whether it's Chevrolet or whether it's Dodge or whatever the case may be, they don't necessarily have that global reach. But I think, obviously, the financial restructuring of the sport was designed specifically because they wanted to introduce cost certainty. So if a company, whether it's a manufacturer or an individual racing team or an individual one to get involved, they can say, look, we can now get involved with Formula One and we can project our costs. It's a much more predictable business model than it was historically. So I think for a couple of reasons, typically American companies and manufacturers didn't want to get involved because there was limited exposure domestically, which is their principal marketing base. And two, the unpredictable nature of the economics made it a bad business case. And I think they would be highly advised against it. I think that possibly changes now. I don't necessarily know who it's going to be or when it's going to happen. But I think Gene Haas, and I think this kind of goes back to what my original point was going to be, I think Gene Haas is holding on to this team for one specific reason. He sees it as an appreciating asset. I think he sees his Formula One team as an NBA team in 2010, mm-hmm. when they were worth about $225 million and there was a bunch available. And I think he wants to go to a place where the NBA teams are now, where the average value of a team might be $1.5 billion. So I think he's holding onto this team and he's making the minimum required financial investments to keep it on the grid. But I think he has every reason to eventually spin it off. And I don't even know if it's going to be a partnership, but I think it will be a sale. And I think when he does, I think Liberty will do everything in its power to make sure it becomes available to an American buyer. Mm-hmm. Now, that said, I don't think, and based on everything I've read, I think if not for the global financial crisis last year, Liberty would have interjected and become much more involved in the partnership with the Mazepan family, that the Russian oligarch. I don't think they were happy about that. But I think they were also in a position last year where there weren't ready buyers because of the pandemic and the lack of capital in the open markets. And I think that was an evil necessity that they didn't want, but they also couldn't afford to be in a position where they lost a team. But ultimately, I hope Gene finds an American buyer, and I appreciate what he's trying to do in terms of kind of flipping this as an appreciating asset. I don't know who it's necessarily going to be. Maybe it is a NASCAR team that has some infrastructure and it has a base and something to build on. But I think the other challenge for North American teams too is that historically, the hinterland, the base of Formula One operations and most of the suppliers is based in the UK. So having a base and a factory in the US doesn't necessarily work when you only race in this hemisphere a couple times a year.
Yeah, the logistical part of it is certainly a very interesting consideration when it comes into this discussion. But I mean, the thing that can't be doubted at the moment is just the groundswell, the increase in the popularity.
For sure.
In the States. And I mean, ultimately, we don't know how long this is going to go or where it's going to end up. But I mean, the seeds that were planted by Liberty Media 3-4 years ago, whatever it was, is certainly starting to grow and bear fruit. And I think it's going to be a fun ride to see where it goes from here. All right. Next question. I'm going to jump back into the email here. Got an email from Jeremy Cunningham. And he says, with nearly a week since the incident in capital letters and all emotions cooled down, I have a question about the future. The new changes coming in 2022 are designed to increase competitive racing. Won't this just lead to more incidents like what transpired on lap one? Or at the very least, more minor penalties similar to Spielberg. And then in brackets, rant about widening tracks not included. Thanks, and absolutely love the show, Jeremy. A great email. Yeah, you know, that's a fascinating question, really. I mean, the whole point of the new aerodynamics coming in on these cars is to decrease the turbulent air for the following car and decrease the cap to the car in front of them, and then to promote opportunities to pass. So I think basically it comes down to guys, keep it clean, race fair, race hard, but don't drive into each other and don't push each other off of the track. But that's interesting. I hadn't even thought of that.
Yeah, it's a great point. And just again, I think it's important to caution our listeners, especially those that are new to F1, that contact happens, and it happens for very different reasons than we see in NASCAR, where that old verbiage, rubbing is racing, that contact is expected and normal. Certainly it's not desirable in F1, but I think, again, like we said earlier, when you have two top tier drivers racing at 180 miles per hour into some of these high speed corners, contact can happen, and it's rarely ever intentional. It's just driver misjudges a corner, their tires don't have much heat, their brake might not be as much heat in the brakes. There's a thousand different reasons why contact can happen, but absolutely, I think that's a really great point, which is if we get closer racing, we may see more contact and we may see more accidents.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, just going back to the previous question about American involvement in a team, Nigel Velli and both Michelle G very active in the chat tonight. Anyways, the comment was, you know who's an American brand that's invested in F1? Netflix. Netflix Formula One team, they can get a whole season of DTS out of it. Plus, there's an interesting mashup. I mean, you could take the F and the L in Netflix and make a very interesting F1 logo crossover.
Yep.
Patent pending. Yep. Can we actually do that? Can we put a patent on somebody else's trademark name like Netflix? Probably not. But you know, that's a great call. You know, why are we thinking of a car manufacturer? I mean, I guess ultimately anybody has the money could set up their own team, but obviously Netflix maybe doesn't have the expertise in building cars. But great call nonetheless. Okay, next Twitter question, comments, whatever you got, hit me with it.
So I think this is a question that we get quite often, and I've never thought to ask it, but one of the questions is, and it's not even so much a question, but it's like, you guys are really interesting, appreciate your passion about F1, and I'm kind of homologating a whole bunch of different questions into one because we get it so often, but tell us a little bit more about each other. What's your background? How did you get into F1? How did you get into sports journalism, podcasting? Where did the podcast come from? And all those kind of things. So I think that's interesting that people are curious and want to learn a little bit more about us. I think people know a lot about me because I'm always on the Spaces chat and I'm super, super big on self-promotion. So people don't get the opportunity not to learn about me. But I think given the fact that we've done such a really great job of building this community and talking about each other, I think there's some value in kind of giving everyone a little bit of background. And I know we did this at the beginning of the season. The question comes up quite often about how we got into F1, but maybe in your case, and I'll do the same, but maybe in your case, talk a little bit about where this podcast came from to begin with, because I think one of the things people are super shocked about when we talk about this in the Spaces is this podcast is 5.5 years old. This long predates DTS, but kind of talk about your background, what you do, your passion for sports, some of your favorite sports, and maybe just kind of share where this podcast came from to begin with.
Yeah, so that's a great question. So at the time, I was I still have a 9-to-5 job. I'm a project manager. In my day job, I'm a professional land surveyor. That's something that I've done for many, many years. But I've always had this love for sports. And a number of years ago, a friend of mine, who at the time was just an acquaintance, came to me with the idea of starting a podcast, starting a blog covering the local MLS team here in Vancouver, the Whitecaps, Vancouver Whitecaps FC. We did that. We became accredited media for the Whitecaps. That changed to other things, not just for Major League Soccer, but Soccer Canada, CONCACAF, FIFA qualifiers. One of the best memories I have was covering Mexico versus Canada at BC Place back in March of 2016, I think it was. That was an amazing night. Just the whole, it was just a circus. It was just a phenomenal. So anyway, so we'd been doing the podcast that started, the soccer one started way back in 2013. And when it came around to 2016, we had basically everything set up. And I mean, I'd been watching Formula One. It was something I grew up with. My dad, my dad's English. He was a Formula One fan. He was his entire life. And that was something we just grew up with. And I thought, well, I'd always wanted to do something about Formula One, be it a blog or whatever it might be. And I thought, well, I'm already doing this, all this other stuff. I've got everything here. So I just decided to do it. I started to start it on my own, which I did. And then, so I did on my own, I think the first year, and then the second year for a couple of years, I did it with another colleague in Montreal. He moved on to other things. You and I, we sort of come into our paths align, I guess, sort of late 2019, 2020, when we were introduced by a mutual friend, which was kind of cool. And then after, Flash F1 wrapped up, then we, your old podcast, we decided to do something together. And that's kind of how it went. But I mean, I'm a lifelong sports fan. I love football. I love basketball, baseball, hockey, so many different things. Soccer is a big one, cycling. And then, the problem that I have, much like yourself, is just having the available bandwidth to really absorb an entire NBA season or NFL season and everything. But Formula One is the one that gets the most attention from me. But the one thing is interesting is certainly over the last year or so, and certainly this year, the amount of growth that we've seen. And what's really exciting is not just downloads, which are always cool, but the interaction and the community and the people that we talk with and we hang out with online, for lack of a better term, each and every week is really cool. And that's one thing that I guess I'd always wanted when I started this, but I had no idea how to build it. And the fact that it sort of seems to be organically growing itself at the grassroots level is really cool. And I mean, a lot of credit to you, because I mean, you've really taken the social media on your own shoulders and really run with that, which is really awesome. So I'm going to throw it back over to you. And you have to unmute your microphone, which I'll do for you, because you just did it again. Anyways, now you can go.
Oh my gosh. Well, I was going to say thank you, by the way, for the kind words regarding the social media. It has led to a borderline divorce and very close to losing my job, because it takes a lot of time, but I think it's absolutely worth it as we continue to build this community. But I went to university way back in 2000. I think I graduated from high school in about 2000. And when I went to high school originally, it was because I was super passionate about journalism and sports. And I thought at one point I was going to play Major League Baseball, and that there was a shot that I was going to get drafted by the Oakland Athletics, which didn't happen. So I went to school and I thought, what's the next best thing? I could write about baseball and write about sports in general. And about a semester into my first year, I realized, wow, I'm not going to get any money for doing this, and it's going to be impossible to find a job. I need to probably figure out a better career. So I ended up switching my degrees to focus on, I think, principally political science and economics, because I thought I could go into economics. I could work for a bank, a financial institution. I could go to work for a think tank and that kind of stuff. Ultimately, my career went in a totally different direction, which is totally fine, because the employer that I've been with now for 20 years as of this October has been nothing but great to me. But about 7 or 8 years ago, I kind of got the sense that maybe I'd missed something with this whole sports piece. And I look back at some of the things that Bill Simmons had done, for instance, which is he kind of predicted the digital wave of sports journalism, where I think a lot of publications like Sports Illustrated missed the mark, and they ultimately faltered and failed by and large as a byproduct. We saw all these other big companies that were born in the digital era because they embraced new concepts like podcasting and blogging and vlogging and all those other kind of things. So about 8-9 years ago, I started getting into the sports photography angle. So I became MLS credentialed and then Major League Baseball, and I did a little bit of work. And over the course of a year and a half, I got a taste of it. And I'll be honest, I love photography, but photographing Major League Baseball and photographing Major League Soccer, it sounds kind of glamorous. I'll be honest, it sucks, and it's impossible to make money, and you have to invest a ton of money in gear, and it's long hours, and you could shoot an entire series over a course of a weekend and not sell a single photo, because typically you sell these photos on to aggregators who make them available to publications, and maybe you sell a shot, maybe you don't. Like, it was a lot of work. So back in 2015, 2016, I thought, I want to get involved a little bit more with what had become one of my big passions, because it's something I share with my wife, which is Formula One. And in 15, 16, I want to do something. I want to start a site. I want to start a podcast. 2019, we kicked off the Flash F1 podcast, ran that for about 100 episodes. It was going really well. We were getting a lot of traction through the pandemic and work. I was exhausted. It was a lot of work. It wasn't directionally growing as quickly as I thought it was, although in hindsight, it was actually growing really, really well. But ultimately, I wrapped it up because I just had too much going on. And then you reached out that fall and we had some conversations about collaborating. I'm like, hey, you know what? Maybe it's worth giving it a second shot. Let's try this. And it's worked since then. But like you, spent a lot of time in Europe, spent a lot of time in the UK, have traveled around, spent a ton of time in the US, especially when I was playing baseball when I was younger. Big movie fan, big pop culture fan. Everybody who follows the Twitter feed knows I'm a huge hip-hop fan as well. I'm a big fan of hip-hop related collectibles and shoes and all that kind of authentic sports gear. But I'm really passionate about F1 because, one, it was kind of cool for a long time to be a fan of a sport that not everyone in our part of the world is a big fan of. So it was kind of cool. And now it's getting exciting because more and more people are becoming attracted to it. But at the same time, it's also a bit, oh my God, is this going to become mainstream? And I never imagined this day would happen. So for that reason, it's really, really exciting. And I think we're just happy to be along on this journey with all of our listeners and overwhelmingly everyone that reaches out. And thank you for that. It's the same story. I just started watching. I watched GNTDTS. This is my first season. I love the show. And we thank all of you for being a part of this journey because that's what's really inspiring us to put in the work and prepare and get these shows ready and get our scripts ready and get our stories ready and all that kind of stuff to bring something to the air that's fun and compelling and insightful and educational. But yeah, great question.
Yeah, awesome. Hey, next one is from Thomas Beto. I hope I pronounced that correctly. Anyways, Thomas has to say, hey guys, with all the talk about ways F1 can give a better fan experience, what do you think of this idea? At the halfway point to the season, after the standings start to take shape, introduce one-on-one Friday duels with your nearest competitor in the championship standings as of each race weekend. Example for Hungary, Lewis versus Max, Lando versus Bottas, Perez versus Leclerc, etc. It's a one-lap duel. Fastest time for each duel gets 2 championship points. Too much too soon. I think it would be great TV. Thanks, Thomas. And his sign-off, it says University of Alabama. So Crimson Tide checking in, which is pretty cool. You know, I love it. I think, you know, it's interesting. And I think that's, you know, they've started to look at alternative ways to increase the spectacle with all this sprint qualifying and the moving the Friday thing around. And I suppose that basically where this I see this evolving is on the success, ultimate success or ultimate failure of the entire sprint qualifying, sprint race, whatever it is, format. And perhaps they might consider something in the future. I mean, the one thing is that Liberty is obviously not afraid of is they're not afraid of trying new things without really... Well, you have to change. You have to try new things if you want to move forward. But I don't think that they want to basically throw the baby out with the bathwater. I think they recognize the value and the history and everything that comes with Formula One. But they obviously are open to trying new things. And I have to admit that this sprint qualifying that we saw last weekend, way better than that rolling cutoff bizarre qualifying thing that we saw back in 2017 or something, which everybody hated right from the beginning. So who knows? Perhaps if this becomes, once it gets dialed in, maybe they'll look at other things. So who knows?
Yeah, I think Liberty walks a really thin line in the sense that obviously we're all very excited about the growth in the US, but let's be honest, the numbers, their numbers relative to the global broadcast whole are still pretty small. We're talking 900,000 to 1.1 million people. That's not a bad number, and it's significant growth, but relatively speaking, versus the total global TV audience for Formula One, it's minuscule. But again, it's a growth story and it's the potential. But I think that the fine line, the nuanced position that Liberty has to manage is, one, you want to grow the sport, you want to enhance the sport, you want to be progressive, you want to find ways to excite these new American fans, these new North American followers, and really everyone else that's come online as a Formula One fan globally, because we keep talking about, hey, Gen DTS is kind of bringing to life this base of new viewers in the United States, but it's also doing the same in traditional markets as well.
Sure.
Like we hear from a lot of Gen DTS in Central America and in South America and Asia. So there's these new fans coming on everywhere. But I think what Formula One has to be careful of, to your point, is you have to be respective you just have to be respectful to the historical structure of the sport, in the sense that you don't want to change it in a way that it would compromise the integrity of the championships that came before, the championships that follow. But at the same time, you also have to understand that the sport is ripe for change, mm-hmm. and you have to find ways to continue to appeal to North American fans. So I think they're in this kind of tricky position where they don't want to alienate their hundreds of billions of existing fans, but they still have to continue to activate and nurture this growing base of Gen TTS viewers. So I love the ideas, and I think it's a lot of fun to talk about, but I think Liberty walks a fine line where they can't be overly dramatic and they can't be overly progressive. But at the same time, when you look at the changes that they've made to the sport since 2017, you're hard pressed to point to any single one of them and say, hey, you failed. And now we can have that conversation specifically about where some of the races are being staged and who maybe some of their partners are. But in terms of the actual spectacle that is the racing, I think you'd be hard pressed to find a criticism of what they're doing on track or how they're promoting the track through the sport through social media mm-hmm. and YouTube and digital channels like the F1 TV app.
Well, there's no doubt there that their digital footprint, their social media footprint is orders of magnitude higher than it was pre-2017. I mean, it was non-existent. I mean, they did the bare minimum in what I call the old days. So absolutely. Yeah. Who knows where it's going to go in the future?
Have we got time for another Twitter question before the break?
Yeah, I was going to say, we're already kind of getting to our normal sort of like a 90-minute time, but we've got so many good messages and questions this week. So let's squeeze in one more, because you obviously have one that you want to get to.
And I feel terrible, and I apologize to Javier Ramos. You tweeted this at me, it feels like weeks ago. I think it was the beginning of June, but it was a great question. Texas Forever. Here's the question. I have a question for the podcast. I am new to Formula One and I am Gen DTS. I read for the French GP that Hamilton Bottas switched chassis. What does that mean? Did they literally switch cars and just replace the numbers? Or is it more nuanced than that? Keep up the great work and hello from Texas, to which I responded once again, Texas Forever, because I've been to Texas a few times and I love that state and the people and the food, and I desperately want to go to Austin. So if anyone can help us get credentialed for the Austin race this October, we would be greatly appreciated. But to answer your question, Formula One doesn't, at least doesn't in modern history, allow teams to bring three cars to the track. What they can do is bring enough spare components that if they need to, they can effectively build a new car. Now, teams, and I was looking through the sporting regulations and the technical regulations earlier today because I wanted to get a little bit of clarity on this and a little bit of consensus. But I believe that over the course of a campaign, teams are allowed to develop or build six individual chassis. And we've talked about this in the past, that a chassis is one of those components that every single team has to build. The chassis is basically the tub that the driver sits in, and all the components are bolted to. The power unit, the gearbox, the drivetrain, the suspension, all of the aero components, the wing, et cetera, et cetera. So all of the teams have to develop this. You cannot buy it from another team. You have to develop it internally. Now, teams can build, I believe, up to six of these per year, and they don't necessarily belong to an individual driver. So you do see circumstances like we saw earlier this year with Hamilton Bottas, where they may choose to switch the individual chassis. Now, sometimes the drivers may object, the engineers may object, and they may assign specific chassis to each individual drivers. But in other cases, you may see them swap them. In the course of a season, it's not unusual as well for some of these chassis to get a little bit tired, so they might swap out the chassis for a fresh one. Or it could be that a chassis is completely destroyed, like we saw with Max Verstappen in Silverstone last week, in which case that is a total write-off and there's nothing that's going to be salvageable from that. But ultimately, they can certainly switch the chassis between the two drivers. All of the components are interchangeable. It will bolt onto it. But in lieu of bringing a third car to a track weekend, which would effectively be a backup car in the event that one of them is destroyed, the teams can only have two functional cars at any given time, but they can absolutely swap the chassis back and forth. And I believe, and please somebody reach out via our DMs and I'll correct myself next week, but to my best of interpretation, when it comes to the technical and sporting regulations, they can build six over the course of a championship campaign.
Yeah, it's definitely not like the old days when they had like the spare car, the T car, whatever they called it back then, because you often see like an opening lap accident where somebody ends up in the gravel, their car is destroyed, and you'd see the driver running through the gravel to hop on a scooter or to a little buggy to get a ride back to the pit lane. So they could jump into the spare car and then make it back onto the grid for the restart. I mean, those days are long gone. But You know, another point is too, is like you say, I mean, these are generic, they're common. You can basically mix and match parts from one car to another. I mean, it's all interchangeable, and it's not, say, something personalized like the driver's seat, which is form fitted to that, you know, that individual driver's, you know, body and their contours and everything like that, which I also believe, I think that not only was Max's car totaled, but I think that he actually broke the seat in his car as well, which the seat, for lack of a better way to describe it, is not like a seat you would see in your truck or your car. It's basically like, I guess it almost looks like a carbon fiber scoop. It's just basically like a, you know, a contoured thing that they sit into. But you always hear, like, just after Christmas, just when you get into the new year, you'll hear once the drivers start coming back from their holidays in the winter that they've gone to the factory, they've had their sort of their initial walkthroughs, they've had their seat fitting, and then that's kind of the first indication of when the season is actually starting, is when they do that. But great question. All right.
That's all we've got from the Twitter mail. Well, actually, we've got lots, but I want to save some for Thursday and for next week.
Cool.
But that's all we got for tonight.
That's awesome. Well, guys, thank you so very much for listening to the show. For those of you watching on the live stream, it's good to know that Monday is now almost over. That Tuesday's coming, and I hate Tuesdays too. I mean, Mondays, you know, suck, but Tuesdays are almost as bad because, you know, you're still a couple of days still before you can get that weekend feeling, but whatever. We still have a weekend and a race coming up, so it's all good. Anyways, that's it for us. Thank you for listening and watching the show. Thanks for all your emails. Thanks for all of you that were watching on the live stream and for the questions and comments. Have a great week. We'll be back on Thursday night as usual to preview the Hungarian Grand Prix. Until then, have a great week. And in the spirit of Texas forever, clear eyes, full hearts, can't lose. Bye for now.